Hey, good morning. It's Patricia Murphy. It's Wednesday. This is Seattle Now. State Attorney General Bob Ferguson wants three drug distributors to pay up for their role in the opioid epidemic. The legal showdown is happening in a courthouse in downtown Seattle. And if Ferguson's office succeeds, the state could have billions of dollars to spend on treatments for people with opioid use disorder. In a minute, we'll talk to Dr. Michelle Peavy about what the treatment landscape looks like right now and what the money could do. But first, some headlines. Thousands of people still have no power after this week's wind and rainstorm caused downed trees and utility lines. More than 500 people have been forced out of their homes thanks to flooding in Whatcom County. One man remains missing there. The images are just unbelievable. Officials are calling it the worst flooding in 31 years. A bit of good news, road crews managed to partially reopen a cut-off portion of I-5 south of Bellingham after it was shut down by a mudslide. Well, we were supposed to know how Washington's new voting maps would look today, but the group in charge of drawing them failed to meet its deadline. These maps decide how our 10 House districts and 49 state legislative districts are laid out. The bipartisan commission was supposed to approve the new map by midnight Tuesday, but it couldn't come to an agreement. The maps it proposed had faced criticism for failing to meet requirements in the Voting Rights Act. Now, the job falls to the state Supreme Court. And the Seattle School Board is taking a stance on vaccine requirements for students. The board will vote tonight on a measure that would ask the state to add COVID vaccines to the list of shots required for public school students. As of right now, there's no plan at the state level to mandate the vaccine. The proposed mandate wouldn't go into effect until after the vaccines are approved by the FDA. A $500 million settlement deal was not enough to stop Washington's lawsuit against major opioid distributors. The trial started Monday. It's the latest in Attorney General Bob Ferguson's fight against the companies he says are responsible for the opioid epidemic. Ferguson says people who have lost loved ones to opioid use disorder want accountability.
They say, hey, the money's important, but what I really want, Bob, is to be able to walk into a courtroom someday and see these individuals testify under oath about what they knew and when they knew it, why they made the decisions they did, and to hear a jury or a judge say what they did was wrong, that they broke the law.
But the attorney general is also asking for cold, hard cash, $38 billion. It's a gamble. Earlier this month, a similar case in California failed. But if Washington's case is successful, a big chunk of those billions would go towards treatment. Dr. Michelle Peavy is here to help us understand what treatment for opioid use disorder looks like. She's a research scientist and clinical psychologist and the host of Drug Talk, a new podcast from the UW's Addictions, Drug, and Alcohol Institute. Hey, Michelle.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And thank you for your interest in people that use opioids.
You know, I think when people imagine someone with opioid use disorder, they probably conjure a stereotype in their head. But the reality is different. Tell me who we're really talking about here.
Any one of us who use opioids to some degree will become physiologically dependent. And so this really can strike truly any one of us. There are predictors also of when people might be more likely to develop an opioid use disorder. Struggling with mental health or other psychosocial issues might be one of those things. And so that might be where this stereotype comes from, that a certain type of person has a substance use disorder or an opioid use disorder. And certainly some people are going to be more vulnerable just based on their situations. Yet, as you kind of alluded to, any one of us can develop an opioid use disorder.
And we know so much, science knows so much more about precursors for drug use and drug dependence, that there is a way to be forward thinking about this. But before we get there, I want to talk about the current landscape. The opioid epidemic has been a big issue for more than a decade now. Where are we today and where are we making headway?
So there's some good news and there's some bright spots here in that we've had mass expansion of treatment availability for people who struggle with an opioid use disorder. And there has been some movement in terms of stigma around opioid use disorder, and importantly, around the medications that are effective in treating opioid use disorder. And so we've had some headway, we've had expansions in availability of treatment. there's some bad news here as well, which is fentanyl being a really powerful opioid that has really shown up across the country and more recently here in the Pacific Northwest, has really undermined some of the changes that we've, the positive changes that we've experienced.
Like we talked about, this has been a problem for more than a decade now. This has been on our radar. What do we know about treatment that works?
We know a lot about treatment. This is really the good news. So there are three FDA-approved medications that target opioid use disorder. They are methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. And the evidence behind these medications is both really promising as well as a pretty ancient when we look at research. So research with methadone, for example, dates back to the 1960s. And here's this, you know, again, highly effective medication that's been in use to target opioid use disorder for all these years. Buprenorphine as well, a little bit of a newer medication, but also very effective. So we know that these medications work.
And when you say these treatments are very effective, what does that mean? What do you mean when you say they are effective?
So for any of us that have worked in this field, we have seen what these medications can do. And I hope it doesn't sound like I'm overstating it when I say for some people, it's kind of like magic. But let me just tell you, as someone who has provided this kind of treatment, that people, when they come in with an opioid use disorder and they have kind of a sense of desperation and hopelessness and pain, and then start initiating a medication for their disorder, and weeks and months later have transformed their lives truly. So they may look different. They may look healthier. They may look into your eyes. Whereas, you know, at the beginning, that might've been hard to do. You know, people will say things like, you know, this really saved my life. And you watch people re-engage with their life. And that might be engaging in relationships. It might be engaging with healthcare. When I say that these treatments work, they work to reduce opioid use, which is important, but they have much kind of more far-reaching outcomes than that, specifically, you know, feeling better, better quality of life.
The ability to see a life beyond what you're in right now. Absolutely.
That's right. Yeah.
So we have these treatments that work really well, but this is still a huge issue. What are the barriers right now for people who need them?
I think part of your question is, why aren't people seeking care? And one reason for this is stigma. So people that have interfaced with healthcare and have felt judged and have felt unwelcome, they will not seek treatment. Stigma has been a problem and will continue to be. I also will say that, you know, even though we've managed to expand treatment, I think it looks a little bit like it's been done on a shoestring, because these, you know, heroic facilities that provide opioid treatment do so kind of, I mean, not for free. You know, they're paid employees, but they're not paid well enough. And they really do so out of concern for the population. But, you know, like other areas of healthcare, in opioid treatment, it's hard to hire and it's hard to keep people. If you're like a person and you're looking for opioid treatment and you go into a place and you really connect with someone and then they leave and then the nurse leaves and then the prescriber leaves, you know, it's really hard. So, you know, for places that serve people with an opioid use disorder, you know, how can we have places of work where people feel like they're valued? And in part, we do that by paying people a reasonable salary, and that they want to be there, because some of this work is really hard. And so we need to both pay people appropriately and have work environments in which people want to work.
It sounds like the Attorney General's settlement, if it goes through, could come in handy for drug treatment in the state. Bob Ferguson turned down $500 million. From opioid manufacturers because he said it wasn't enough money to address the problem here. Again, now he wants $38 billion. If you were him and we got that money, where would you put this money?
Mm-hmm. So first, as I kind of mentioned, I would plump up the workforce and pump some money into a system and really make sure that the quality of care that's offered is the best we can provide. So that's the first thing that I would do. And then, you know, I'm thinking about the person with an opioid use disorder, and behavior change is hard as it is. It's hard for any one of us. But when you're talking about changing a behavior like opioid use, where it is so all-consuming, you know, that just feels like the biggest mountain to climb. How can we expect people to do that when they don't have a place to live, when they don't have a ride to the clinic, when they don't have adequate transportation, when their mental health needs are not being met, when their physical health needs are not being met? So there's a part of the larger issue, which is addressing some of these other areas, which are, I guess I should say, they are directly related to opioid use and opioid treatment.
The other piece of this is about accountability. And Bob Ferguson says he wants a judge or a jury to say, yes, these companies are responsible. And I am curious, what does that look like for you and the people you work with? What would accountability mean?
You know, that is a really good question. It's important to see the origins of the problem, but it's really hard to make that kind of a primary focus when what we're seeing are people dying and what we're seeing are people that are in need of treatment. So I'm really glad that, you know, there are efforts being made for mistakes that are now almost quarter century old, really a couple decades old. But it's not for me. And for a lot of people that are kind of doing the day-to-day work of opioid treatment, it's not really on our minds. The funding is really attractive, but many of us have kind of moved on and have been laser-focused on, okay, what do we do now?
Dr. Michelle Peavy, clinical psychologist, research scientist, and host of Drug Talk, a new podcast from the UW's Addictions, Drug, and Alcohol Institute. Really good to talk to you. Thank you for your insight.
Thank you so much for having me, Patricia.
Thanks for listening today. Claire McGrain produced today's show. Our production team is Diana Opong, Caroline Chamberlain Gomez, Jenny Cecil Moore, and Jason Pagano. Matt Jorgensen does our theme music. I'm Patricia Murphy.